Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Fellow ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me today for another installment of Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community. My name is Michael Wolin. I'm going to begin with a Dvar Torah, and in fact, much of the reading today will be Dvar Torah, words from the Torah, because Passover is just around the corner. As I'm speaking now, it will be Wednesday this coming week. That'll be April 5th, will be the first Seder. So let's start with some commentary by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks on a topic that's not directly related to Passover, although it is related to Passover, but it's something that is widely, widely misunderstood in the modern world, and that's the idea of sacrifice. Well, this is Parsha Tzav, and the title of Rabbi Sacks' commentary is Understanding Sacrifice. One of the most difficult elements of the Torah and the way of life it presents is the phenomenon of animal sacrifice, for obvious reasons. First, Jews and Judaism have survived without them for almost 2,000 years. And second, virtually all the prophets were critical of them, not least Jeremiah in this week's Haftarah. None of the prophets sought to abolish sacrifice, but they were severely critical of those who offered them, while at the same time oppressing or exploiting their fellow human beings. What disturbed them, what disturbed God in whose name they spoke, was that evidently some people thought of sacrifices as a kind of a bribe. If we make a generous enough gift to God, then he may overlook our crimes and our misdemeanors. This is an idea radically incompatible with Judaism. Then again, along with monarchy, sacrifices were among the least distinctive features of Judaism in ancient times. Every ancient religion in those days, every cult, every sect, all of them, had its altars and sacrifices. Finally, it remains remarkable how simply and smoothly the sages were able to construct substitutes for sacrifice. Three in particular, prayer, study, and tzedakah. Now, the root of that word is justice. Prayer, particularly shachrit, morning prayer, mincha, the afternoon prayer, musaf, took a place of the regular offerings. One who studies the laws of sacrifice as if he had brought a sacrifice. And one who gives to charity brings, as it were, a financial sacrifice, acknowledging that all we have, we owe to God. So, though we pray daily for the rebuilding of the temple and the restoration of sacrifices, the principle of sacrifice itself remains hard to understand. Many theories have been advanced by anthropologists, psychologists, and Bible scholars as to what the sacrifices represented, but most are based on the questionable assumption that sacrifice is essentially the same act across cultures. This is poor scholarship. Always seek to understand a practice in terms of the distinctive beliefs of the culture in which it takes place. What could sacrifice possibly mean in a religion in which God is the creator and owner of everything? What then was sacrifice in Judaism, and why does it remain important, at least as an idea, even today? The simplest answer, though it does not explain the details of the different kinds of offering, is this. We love what we are willing to make sacrifices for. That is why, when they were a nation of farmers and shepherds, the Israelites demonstrated their love of God by bringing him a symbolic gift of their flocks and herds, their grain and fruit, that is, their livelihood. To love is to thank. To love is to want to bring an offering to the beloved. To love is to give. Sacrifice is the choreography of love. This is true in many aspects of life. A happily married couple is constantly making sacrifices for one another. Parents make huge sacrifices for their children. People drawn to a calling, medicine, for example, to heal the sick, or care for the poor, or fight for justice for the weak against the strong, often sacrifice remunerative careers for the sake of their ideals. In ages of patriotism, people make sacrifices for their country. In strong communities, people make sacrifices for one another when someone is in distress or needs help. Sacrifice is the superglue of relationships. It bonds us to one another. That's why, in the biblical age, sacrifices were so important. Not as they were in other faiths, but precisely because at the beating heart of Judaism is love. Quote, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might." In other faiths, the driving motive behind sacrifice was fear. Fear of the anger, fear of the power of the gods. In Judaism, it was love. We see this in the Hebrew word for sacrifice itself, the noun korban, and the verb lechakrit, which means to come close, to bring close. The name of God invariably used in connection with the sacrifices is Hashem, God in this aspect of love and compassion, never Elohim, God as justice and distance. The word Elohim occurs only 5 times in the whole book of Vayikra, and always in the context of other nations. The word Hashem appears 209 times, and as we saw last week, the very name of the book, Vayikra, means to summon in love. Where there is love, there is sacrifice. Once we realize this, we begin to understand how deeply relevant the concept of sacrifice is in the 21st century. The major institutions of the modern world, the liberal democratic state, and the free market economy, were predicated on the model of the rational actor, that is, one who acts to maximize benefits to themselves. Hobbes' account of the social contract was that it is in the interest of each of us to hand over some of our rights to a central power charged with ensuring the rule of law and the defense of the realm. Adam Smith's insight into the market economy was that if we each act to maximize our own advantage, the result is the growth of the commonwealth. Modern politics and economics were built on the foundation of the rational pursuit of self-interest. There is nothing wrong with this. It was done for the highest of motives. It was an attempt to create peace in a Europe that had for centuries been ravaged by war. The democratic state and the market economy were serious attempts to harness the power of self-interest to combat the destructive passions that led to violence. The fact that politics and economics were based on self-interest did not negate the possibility that families and communities were sustained by altruism. It was a good system, not a bad one. Now, however, after several centuries, the idea of love as sacrifice has grown thin in many areas of life. We see this specifically in relationships. Throughout the West, fewer people are getting married. They are getting married later, and almost half of marriages end in divorce. Throughout Europe, indigenous populations are in decline. To have a stable population, a country must have an average birth rate of 2.1 children per female. In 2015, the average birth rate throughout the European Union was 1.55. In Spain, it was 1.27. Germany has the lowest birth rate of any country in the world. That is why the population of Europe is today rendered stable only on the basis of unprecedented rates of immigration. Lose the concept of sacrifice within a society, and sooner or later marriage falters, parenthood declines, and the society slowly ages and dies. My late predecessor, Lord Jacobovitz, had a lovely way of putting this. The Talmud says that when a man divorces his first wife, the altar sheds tears. That's Talmud, that's Gittin 90b. What is the connection between the altar and a marriage? Both, he said, are about sacrifices. Marriages fail when partners are unwilling to make sacrifices for one another. Jews and Judaism survived despite the many sacrifices people had to make for it. In the 11th century, Judah Halevi expressed something closer to awe at the fact that Jews stayed Jewish despite the fact that, quote, with a word lightly spoken, end quote, they could have converted to the majority faith and survived a life of relative ease. Equally possible, though, is that Judaism survived because of those sacrifices. Where people make sacrifices for their ideals, the ideals stay strong. Sacrifice is an expression of love. Not all sacrifice is holy. Today, suicide bombers sacrifice their lives and those of their victims in a way I have argued is sacrilege. Indeed, the very existence of animal sacrifice in the Torah may have been a way of preventing people from offering human sacrifice in the form of violence and war. But the principle of sacrifice remains. It is the gift we bring to what and to whom we love. Interesting ideas in an age that is desperately in need of spiritual guidance. That's Parsha Tzav, Understanding the Sacrifice, and that is from the book of Vayikra. Well, let's continue on here. Some other commentary by Rabbi Sacks. This on Passover, on the Seder. And this is just some Jewish thought. He titles this, The Missing Fifth. Here's what he has to say. Many commentators, among them the Vilna Gaon, have drawn attention to the influence of the number four in connection with the Haggadah. The Haggadah, of course, is the order, the way you conduct the Seder. There are four fours. The four questions, the four children, the four cups of wine, the four expressions of redemption. I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians and deliver you from their slavery. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty judgment. I will take you to me as a nation. That's from the book of Exodus, chapter 6, verses 6 through 7. It may be, though, that just as an X-ray can reveal an earlier painting beneath the surface of a later one, so beneath the surface of the Haggadah there is another pattern to be discerned. The first thing to note is that there is, in fact, another four on the Seder night, namely, the four biblical verses whose exposition forms an important part of the Haggadah. An Aramaean sought my father's death, and the Egyptians dealt cruelly with us and oppressed us. And we cried to the Lord, God of our ancestors, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt. This is from Deuteronomy chapter 26, verses 5 through 8. There are then not four fours, but five fours. In early editions of the Talmudic tractate Pesachim, 118a, there is a passage that perplexed the medieval commentators, and it is, Rabbi Tarfon says, over the fifth cup we recite the great Hallel. The medieval commentators were puzzled by this, because elsewhere the rabbinic literature speaks about four cups, not five. The Mishnah, for example, states that a poor person must be supplied with enough money to buy four cups of wine. In both the Babylonian and the Jerusalem Talmuds, the discussion revolves around the assumption that there are four cups on Seder night. How, then, are we to understand the statement of Rabbi Tarfon that there is a fifth cup? Among the commentators, three views emerged. The first was that of Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo ben Yitzchak, whose years were 1040 to 1105 of the Common Age, and the Tosafists. According to them, there are only four cups on the Seder night, and it is forbidden to drink a fifth. The statement of Rabbi Tarfon must therefore be a misprint, and the text of the Talmud should be amended accordingly. Well, another view was that of Maimonides. He holds that there is a fifth cup, but unlike the other four, it is optional rather than obligatory. The Mishnah that teaches that a poor person must be given enough money to buy four cupfuls of wine means that we must ensure that he has the opportunity to fulfill his obligation. It does not extend to the fifth cup, which is permitted but not compulsory. Rabbi Tarfon's statement is to be understood to mean that those who wish to drink a fifth cup should do so during the recitation of the great Hallel, or Thanksgiving. Praise. The third view, that of Ravad of Poskieris, a contemporary of Maimonides, is that one should drink a fifth cup. There is a difference in Jewish law between an obligation or a chova, and a religiously significant good deed, a commandment, a mitzvah. The first four cups are obligatory. The fifth is a mitzvah, meaning not obligatory, but still praiseworthy, and not merely, as Maimonides taught, optional. Thus, there was a controversy over the fifth cup. Rashi said we should not drink it. Rambam said that we may drink it. Ravad said that we should drink it. What does one do faced with this kind of disagreement? Jewish law tries, wherever possible, to propose a solution that pays respect to all views, especially when they are held by great halachic authorities. The solution in the present case was simple. A fifth cup is poured out of respect for Ravad and Maimonides, but not drunk out of respect for Rashi. When a disagreement in the Talmud is not resolved, the sages often use the word teku, let it stand. We believe such disagreements will be resolved in the time to come, when Elijah arrives to announce the coming of the Moshiach, the Messiah. One of his roles will be to rule on unresolved halachic controversies. An allusion to this task is to be found in the word teku itself, which was read as an abbreviation of Tishbi Yetaretz Kushiyot Ve'ibayot. The Tishbite, Elijah, will answer questions and difficulties. This is therefore in the history behind the cup of Elijah. The cup we all pour after the meal or during the meal, but do not drink, It represents the fifth cup mentioned in the Talmud. According to the Jerusalem Talmud, the reason we have four cups of wine is because of the four expressions of redemption in God's promise to Moses. How then could Rabbi Tarfon suggest that there are not four cups, but five? The fascinating fact is that if we look at the biblical passage, there are not four expressions of redemption, but five. The passage continues, "And I will bring you to the land I swore, with an uplifted hand, to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord." There is a further missing fifth. Well, as mentioned above earlier, during the course of reciting the Haggadah, we expound four biblical verses, beginning with, "An Aramaean sought my father's death." In biblical times, this was the declaration made by someone bringing first fruits to Jerusalem. However, if we turn to the source, we discover that there is a fifth verse to this passage. Quote, "He brought us to this place, the land of Israel, and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. That's in Deuteronomy chapter 26, verse 9. We do not recite or expound this verse at the Seder table. But this is strange, since the Mishnah states explicitly, "And one must expound the passage beginning with, 'An Aramaean sought my father's death,' until one has completed the whole passage." In fact, we do not complete the whole passage, despite the Mishnah's instructions. So, there are three missing fifths: the fifth cup, the fifth expression of redemption, and the fifth verse. And it is also clear why. All three refer to God's not merely bringing the Jewish people out of Egypt, but also bringing them into the land of Israel. The Haggadah, as we now have it, and as it evolved in rabbinic times, is, in Maimonides' words, the Haggadah as practiced in the time of exile, meaning during the period of the dispersion. The missing fifth represented the missing element in redemption. How could Jews celebrate arriving in the land of Israel when they were in exile? How could they drink the last cup of redemption when they had said at the beginning of the Seder, "Now we are slaves. Next year we shall be free. Now we are here. Next year in the land of Israel." The fifth cup, poured but not drunk, was like the cup broken at Jewish weddings. It was a symbol of incompletion. It meant that as long as Jews were dispersed throughout the world, facing persecution and danger, they could not yet celebrate to the full. One great sage of the 20th century, the late Rabbi Menachem Kasher, argued that now there is a state of Israel, many exiles have been ingathered, and Jews have recovered their sovereignty and land. The fifth cup should be reinstated. Well, that's a question, possibility, that remains for the halachic authorities to decide. What, though, of the four questions and the four children? There was a fifth question. The Mishnah states that a child should ask, "On every other night we eat meat that is cooked, boiled, or roasted, but this night only roasted meat." This text can still be found in the early manuscripts of the Haggadah discovered in the Cairo Geniza. It refers to the time when the temple stood and the food eaten at the Seder included the Paschal offering, which was roasted. After the temple was destroyed and the practice of eating a Paschal lamb was discontinued, this question was dropped, and another about reclining was substituted. Was there a fifth child? The late Lubavitcher Rebbe suggested that there is a fifth child on Pesach, The four children of the Haggadah are all present, sitting round the table. The fifth child is the one who is not there, the child lost throughout marriage and assimilation. Rabbinic tradition tells us that in Egypt, many Jews assimilated and did not want to leave. The Torah uses a phrase to describe the Israelites' departure from Egypt. V'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael mimitzrayim. And that's from the book of Exodus, chapter 13, verse 18. This is normally translated as, the Israelites went up out of Egypt, armed for battle. However, Rashi, citing earlier authorities, suggests that chamush may not mean armed. Instead, it may be related to the word chamesh, meaning five. The sentence could therefore be translated as, only a fifth of the Israelites left Egypt. The rest, he explains, perished in the plague of darkness. The plague itself was less an affliction of the Egyptians than a way of covering the shame of the Israelites, that so many of their number did not want to leave. Certainly, the loss of Jews through assimilation has been an ongoing tragedy of Jewish history. How do we allude to it on Seder night? By silence. The fifth child, the one who is not there. So beneath the surface of the Haggadah, we find not fours, but five fives. Not four fours, rather, but five fives. In each case, there is a missing fifth, a cup, an expression of deliverance, a verse, a question, and a child. Each points to something incomplete in our present situation. In the half century since the Holocaust, the Jewish people have emerged from darkness to light. The state of Israel has come into being. The Hebrew language has been reborn. Jews have been brought to safety from the countries where they faced persecution. In the liberal democracies of the West, Jews have gained freedom and even prominence and affluence. But Israel is not yet at peace. In the diaspora, assimilation continues apace. Many Jews are estranged from their people and their faith. Something is missing from our celebration. The fifth cup, the fifth deliverance, the fifth verse, the fifth question, and the fifth child. That is a measure of what is still to be achieved. We have not yet reached our destination. The missing fifths remind us of work still to be done, a journey not yet complete. Well, that's Rabbi Yonatan Sacks commenting on the missing fifth. Rabbi Sacks always is interesting, always is insightful, always takes you deeper. Well, once again, the missing fifth. Well, let's move on here. Here's something. This is also Rabbi Sacks. This is just a short little commentary. And he asks the question, about Pesach. What does Pesach and the musical production Hamilton have in common? Well, he begins this with this commentary in general about Pesach. He says, Pesach is the oldest and most transformative story of hope ever told. It tells of how an otherwise undistinguished group of slaves found their way to freedom from the greatest and longest-lived empire of their time, indeed of any time. It tells the revolutionary story of how the supreme power intervened in history to liberate the supremely powerless. It's a story of the defeat of probability by the force of possibility. It defines what it is to be a Jew. a living symbol of hope. Freedom is not won in a single moment. It needs to be fought for in every generation. That's a statement repeated by many people, but most recently in my memory, by Ronald Reagan, who emphasized and stated repeatedly that freedom must be fought for in every generation. The philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, inspiration of the French Revolution, believed that Moshe Rabbeinu, that is Moses, was the greatest leader who ever lived, because he was able to take a group of runaway slaves and turn them into a nation. And not just any nation, but a nation with the most tenacious identity of any nation in history, because it kept it, despite the fact it lost its land, it lost its power, it lost its home. And he believed that this was the most extraordinary achievement ever. What he did not fully understand was how that was achieved. A key part of the answer to that question lies in the Seder, in Passover, the Seder service, and the Haggadah. The way we hand on our story to the next generation as the next generation asks its questions, Manishtana, which are ways of saying, who am I? And we hand on this story. The story of that first Pesach is remarkable because if you look in the Torah, in Parsha Bo, you see that when Moshe, on the brink of the Exodus, gathers people together, he doesn't talk about any of the obvious subjects, freedom, or the land, or the milk and honey, or the challenges of the journey. Instead, three times, he talks about the duty of telling our story to our children. V'haya ki yish alecha v'incha machar. When your child asks you, V'haya ki yomru alechem b'nechem. When your children say such and such to you. V'higedata v'hincha b'yom ha'u. You shall tell your child on that day. Three times he talks about telling our story to our children throughout the generations. Those examples I just cited, all from the book of Exodus. Why so? Because Moshe Rabbeinu understood that freedom is not won in a single moment. It needs to be fought for in every generation. And that means handing on to our children three very important gifts. Number one, the gift of identity. Who am I? Number two, the gift of values. How shall I live? And number three, the sense of continuity. That they are a part of a story which includes us, as our story includes them. Education as the conversation between the generations. Once you do that, your identity becomes extraordinary and indelible. Some years ago, I was given an award at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., and I spoke about the difference between the memorials in Washington and in London. In Washington, all the memorials tell a story. You have the Jefferson Memorial with screeds of text, the Lincoln Memorial with a Gettysburg Address on one side and the second inaugural on the other, the Roosevelt Memorial with the key sentences from each of the decades he spent in public life, and the Martin Luther King Memorial with more than a dozen quotations from his speeches. Whereas in London, the memorial for David Lloyd George consists of only three words, David Lloyd George. Nelson Mandela gets two, Nelson and Mandela. And Churchill, deliverer of some of the greatest speeches in history, gets one, Churchill. In America, a memorial is something you read. In Britain, it is something you see. In America, a memorial tells a story. In Britain, it doesn't. Why? Because Britain took freedom for granted. America knew you have to fight for freedom. Fight against the British, as it happens, but that's another story. You have to maintain that identity and tell the story. What Pesach tells us is that values can be and should be universal. Freedom, justice, human dignity. But identity is always particular, and it always comes with a story. And that is why, because we never stopped telling the story on Pesach, we never ever lost our identity in all those many centuries and all those many dispersions. That is what we give our children on Pesach. Number one, the knowledge of who they are. Number two, a sense of how to live. And number three, a sense of continuity that they are building on what we began. Those three things are great gifts. A gifted young composer and dramatist called Lin-Manuel Miranda some years ago wrote a musical. You may have heard of it, called Hamilton. It ends with the last song in the musical with three questions. Who remembers our name? Who keeps our flame? Who tells our story? Because of Pesach, we will always remember our name. We will always keep the flame. We will always tell the story. The longest, oldest, most inspiring story the world has ever known. And in concluding, Rabbi Sacks wishes everyone a meaningful and safe Pesach, especially now in these challenging times. Interesting what Pesach and the musical Hamilton have in common. Well, let's see how we're doing for time here. Let me take some time to talk about the plagues. Now, this is an interesting commentary. This is from Chabad, Chabad.org, which is an incredibly large, deep repository of Jewish thought. And a commentary is by Rabbi Yosef Jacobson on the Ten Plagues. Has some interesting things to say. A traveler once was stopped by a highway robber who demanded his money bag at gunpoint. "I'll give you my money," said the traveler, "but please, if I come home empty-handed, my wife will never believe I was robbed and will accuse me of having squandered the money on gambling or liquor, and she will beat me mercilessly. Please, do me a favor of firing several bullets through my hat so I can prove to her that I was held up." The robber saw no reason not to comply and shot several times through the man's hat. "Thank you so much," the traveler said, and then paused. "But you don't know my wife. She will say I punctured the hat, that these were not bullet holes at all. Here, take my coat, shoot several bullets through it at close range, leaving powder marks. That will convince her for sure." When the traveler saw that the last pull of the trigger hit an empty chamber, he pounced on the robber, knocking him to the ground, grabbed his money bag, and fled. Well, this story, told by Hasidic master Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, conveys the tragic pattern of many persons' life. We each have a thief, or a negative inclination, lingering within us. The thief continuously wishes to rob us of our inner goodness and spirituality. Yet many of us discover the willingness and the power to battle our thief only after he has fired all his bullets against us. Only after allowing our unhealthy addictions and impulses to consume our lives do we realize that they are hollow and empty, and finally, hopefully, finally, find the courage to subdue the thief and embark on a path of recovery. The famous 10 plagues recorded in the Torah are not to be viewed as merely a set of supernatural occurrences that wrecked the Egyptian Empire around 3,300 years ago. The Torah is not only a book recording ancient tales, but a blueprint for life, a manual for the development of the human race. Therefore, the episodes recorded in the Torah represent timeless spiritual tales occurring continuously in the heart of each man. How are we to apply the story of the 10 plagues to our personal lives in the 21st century? The Kabbalah teaches that every human soul is comprised of 10 points of energy, 10 characteristics that make up its inner personality. The first three form the subconscious identity of the soul and its cognitive power. The seven constitute the emotional persona of the soul. These 10 characteristics, also known as the 10 spherotes or the lights, are enumerated in Kabbalah in the following manner. I'm going to just read these now, the Hebrew name, the English translation, and then what plague they represent. The Hebrew name is Keter, and it can be translated as supraconscious, and the plague is the death of the firstborn. The next, Chochmah, translated as conception, and the plague is darkness. The Hebrew is Bina, translated as intelligence, and the plague is locusts. Next, Chesed, translated as love, and the plague is hail. Givura, translated as rejection, and the plague is boils. Now the Hebrew Teferet, translated as compassion, and the plague is epidemic. The Hebrew Netzach, translated as ambition, and the plague is devouring beasts. The Hebrew is Hod, meaning submission. The plague is lice. The Hebrew Isod, English is bonding, and the plague is frogs. And last, Malchut, translated as confidence, and the plague is blood. Now, Hebrew words, like many English words, words in any language, have multiple meanings, and their meaning is often contextual, how it's used in a sentence. So if you believe there are other translations for some of these, Gevura or Netzach or any of them, you're probably right. These are in the context of the plagues, and that's how we'll be discussing it here by Rabbi Jacobson. He goes on to say, each of us is given a choice in life. We may either refine and repair these 10 attributes so that they express our inner divine light, or we may pervert and corrupt these very same attributes by using them in unhealthy and often immoral ways. Ancient Egypt, with its demonic program of systematically eliminating an entire people, the Hebrews, from the face of the earth, chose to embark on the latter path, using our attributes in unhealthy and immoral ways. The original Egyptian nation perverted all 10 attributes of its soul. The negative energy engendered by the perversion of so many human spirits returned back to Egypt in the form of 10 plagues that befell the country. In our personal lives, Egypt reflects a state of psychological dysfunction, in which one or many of the soul's attributes become distorted and dysfunctional, hindering a human being's ability for true self-actualization and fulfillment. This is indicated in the Hebrew name for Egypt, Mitzrayim, which may be translated as constraint, restriction, inhibitions. When we fail to confront our own demons, our perverted attributes can return to us in the form of psychological plagues. The 10 plagues thus correspond to the 10 spherot, and in opposite order that I read them, let's discuss each of the plagues. The first, which was the last of the plagues, blood, destructive confidence. The first plague, in which the Nile River turned into blood, was a physical symbol of the destructive confidence that became the hallmark of Egypt, the geographical as well as the psychological Egypt. Instead of a constructive confidence that builds one's spiritual character and fosters sensitivity to others, Egyptian confidence bred dominance and exploitation of other people. When one's perception of confidence becomes truly corrupt, it can lead that person to generate rivers of blood, as the Egyptians indeed did. The Nile River embodied the source of Egyptian confidence and security. Since little rain falls in Egypt, the country's agriculture and sustenance are completely dependent on the Nile. Therefore, the ancient Egyptians actually deified the Nile. The waters of the Nile turning into blood reflected the perverse state of a nation which turns its confidence into blood, using its position of strength and power to slaughter and butcher countless innocent people. Number two, frogs. That's the next plague. Cold intimacy. The second plague, in which swarms of frogs inundated Egypt, symbolized the cold and dispassionate intimacy characterizing a person who lives in a psychological Egypt. Frogs are cold-blooded amphibious creatures, and they hatch in cold climates. Female frogs usually deposit their eggs in water, where they hatch into tadpoles. Also, land-dwelling frogs deposit their eggs in cold and moist holes. Due to this, and to the fact that eggs deposited in this fashion receive no parental protection, frogs came to reflect in Kabbalah an emotional state of apathy, detachment, and coldness. This condition robs a human being of the ability to experience genuine emotional intimacy with any other person, a spouse, a child, or a friend. The frog personality is the person who, when asked, "What's the difference between ignorance and apathy?" replied, "I don't know," and "I don't care." The third plague, lice. Unhealthy submission. The third plague, in which the dust of Egypt turned into lice, reflected the symptoms of unhealthy submission. The attribute of submission, like all attributes of the soul, can be productive or destructive. To forever remain a humble student of life's lessons is one of the noblest character traits an individual can possess. The ability to surrender one's ego to a higher truth is the foundation for all spiritual growth, as is the capacity to confess an error or wrongdoing. "May my soul be like dust" is a daily Jewish prayer that expresses our wish that we remain humble in the presence of life's mysteries. That is healthy humility and submission. Destructive Egyptian submission is a humility that crushes one's spirit and dulls its zest for life. In this type of submission, where one thinks of himself as a worthless creature who doesn't matter, the perception of the self as useless dust develops into lice that demoralize and debase one's life. Like the dust turned to lice of Egypt, this type of humility sucks out of a person's blood, depriving him of his vitality and energy flow. The holy Rabbi Aaron of Karlin put it in these words: "Depression is not a sin, yet what depression does, no sin can do." The fourth plague, devouring beasts. The fourth plague, in which a swarm of devouring beasts attacked Egypt, is the physical symbol of unhealthy ambition. Ambition is one of the greatest gifts in life. Ambition is the engine that drives a person to achieve greatness and make a difference in the world. Yet, if we do not refine this character trait, our ambitions can turn us into devouring beasts that crush and destroy the people we perceive to be standing in the way of the fulfillment of our goals. The fifth epidemic, sly compassion. The fifth plague is epidemic, sly compassion, in which an epidemic annihilated the Egyptians' cattle, served as the physical embodiment of the attribute of sly compassion, which, like an epidemic, harms people silently and inconspicuously. What is compassion? The Kabbalah teaches and states that compassion is more powerful and more enduring than love. Love usually overlooks the flaws of a beloved one. Therefore, when flaws do emerge, they may weaken love, if not destroy it totally. Compassion, on the other hand, takes into consideration the flaws of the individual in need of compassion and extends a helping heart and hand, regardless. This is holy compassion, the ability of a soul to experience the pain and needs of a fellow human being. Egyptian compassion is sly, shrewd, and deceitful. Its well-finessed and seductive compassion is employed in order to exploit other people's weaknesses for selfish purposes and destructive goals. When one uses compassion in this manner, it inflicts damage on the person in the silent and deadly way of an epidemic. The sixth plague, boils, means brutal rejection. The sixth plague, in which embers from a hot furnace hurled over the land developed into boils on the skin of the Egyptian population, and it was the physical symbol of cruel rejection. In Kabbalah, fire embodies the emotion of rejection, the soul's capacity to refuse a person or a thing. Like fire, an act or a word of rejection may scorch or even demolish the one who is rejected. An additional connection between fire and rejection lies in the fact that fire surges upwards, moving away from the earth. Rejection, too, constitutes an act of traveling inward and upward into one's own world, removing oneself from the people and the events in one's environment. Yet, a healthy soul needs to know how to reject as much as it must know how to embrace. One is often called upon to refuse a destructive urge, to sever an unhealthy relationship, to say no to a spoiled child or an unethical business offer. That is healthy fire. It is a fire that destroys the negative in order to build the positive. However, when our inner capacity for rejection turns into hate, bitterness, and cruelty, the embers of our soul become a destructive force. Like boils, they infect our lives and the lives of people around us. The seventh plague, hail, frozen love. The seventh plague, in which produce-destroying hail descended upon Egypt, was symbolic of selfish love. If fire symbolizes rejection, it is water, naturally descending from a higher place to a lower one, that embodies the qualities of generosity and loving kindness. In Kabbalah, the flow of love is compared to a flow of water, irrigating and nourishing a human soul with its refreshing vibrancy. Yet a person who finds himself in Egyptian bondage knows only an icy love, a love based entirely on self-seeking motives and self-centered considerations. This person's rain-like flow of love becomes cold and frozen like hail, harming the beloved ones instead of nurturing them. Parshas Vayera and Bo, from the heart to the mind. It is not a coincidence that the 10 plagues are recorded in two different sections of the Bible, the first 7 in the Parsha Vayera, and the final 3 in the Parsha of Bo. The first 7 plagues, blood, frogs, lice, devouring beasts, epidemic, boils, and hail, reflected the Egyptian perversion of the 7 emotions: confidence, bonding, submission, ambition, compassion, rejection, and love. The last 3 plagues, locusts, darkness, and death of the firstborn, represented the more severe corruption of the intellectual faculties and supraconscious dimensions of the Egyptian soul. When one's emotions and instincts are impaired, the sane and objective mind offers hope for healing. When a person's mind starts playing ugly games, the path towards recovery becomes painstakingly challenging. And now the 8th plague, locusts, perverted intelligence. This plague, in which invading locusts left nothing green throughout Egypt, serves as a symbol of the destructive consequences of a corrupted mind. The ability of intellectual inquiry and scrutiny remains the singular, most precious gift of the human race. It allows us to explore the universe, improve our lives, and discover a higher moral calling of the human family. Yet that very same power serves often as a tool to rationalize every evil practiced under the sun, and to justify every destructive lifestyle or habit. Like the locust swarm that consumed all the existing plants of Egypt, leaving in its wake a barren soil, the corrupt mind can uproot every existing moral structure, every established sacred foundation, leaving in its wake a desolate society bereft of spiritual values or absolute principles. This is the tragedy of Egyptian intellectualism, where one becomes so open-minded that their brains fall out. Darkness, a locked mind. The 9th plague, in which darkness pervaded Egypt, reflected the inability of the inhibited Egyptian soul to actualize its faculty of conception. That power is the ability of one's mind to conceive a new and original idea previously inaccessible. And that happens by the mind realizing its limitations and its borders, suspending its intellectual ego, and opening itself up to a higher light. When a person is arrogant and smug, he denies his mind's ability to experience illumination, which forces him to remain in darkness, in his own narrow vision of life. And finally, death of the firstborn, death of identity. The 10th plague and last one, during which the firstborn of Egypt died, was the most devastating of all, and it reflected the fact that Egyptian abuse of the soul did not only affect its conscious faculties, but distorted its supraconscious forces as well. This was the final bullet that put an end to the vicious cycle of Egyptian addiction and abuse. The Jewish people were set free. They were well on their way to receive the 10 Commandments. What are the 10 Commandments? They correspond to the 10 plagues. Just as the plagues reflected the perversion of the 10 faculties of the soul, the 10 Commandments represent a path of spiritual healing in each of the 10 faculties, allowing them to express harmony and splendor of man's divine essence. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was a long piece. I hope you got something from it, at least enjoyed listening to it. I want to thank you for joining me today for readings of interest to the Jewish community, and remind you my name is Michael Wolin, and I'd like to wish all of you good Shabbos, Shabbat Shalom, Shavua Tov. Have a good week.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org. or by calling 303-786-7777.